Bink, the humble monster.
Your favorite Instagram spot.
That's where I do. That's where I do my laundry at. You feel me?
Hey, that, absolutely. That's what all goes down at the chop shop right there.
What's going on, King?
I ain't nothing, brother. Just glad you came on, man. Long overdue. No, I had to get you up here.
Man, I love where you at with this platform, man. It's very much needed. You feel me? It ain't a lot of cats I function with in respect to be talking on this platform, man. It's a lot of imposters out there that don't really respect the culture and the,
speak on it
and reciprocate the real true history of what's going on. But I'm loving, man.
Without further ado, you know, West Coast to me, one of the guys who defined the West Coast sound. You know, in my opinion, you know what I'm saying? The backbone of the West Coast sound, you know, gave Corrupt his sound and Snoop and all types of backgrounds for all types of other LA artists. My man, Battle Cat, West Coast King. What's up with you, bro?
Come on, baby.
Yeah.
Let me take these damn glasses off so you can see me, man.
That part. There you go. There are the lights.
Yeah. Yeah, there we go.
Yeah. So shit, man, I didn't realize you came in '88, though.
Yeah, man, that was a crazy time for me. I just had my first kid, and man, R&B was at an all-time high. Teddy was doing his thing with Keith Sweat. Radio was at an all-time high. All my DJ mentors and everybody that I know that is DJing adopted, you know, real quick in how to engineer and then becoming producers, beat makers, then producers. So I'm already a drummer by nature, so I had to fall in because I didn't want the streets to take me under. And I'm glad that my neighborhood supported me like that, you know what I'm saying, instead of trying to adopt me till they get down, you know, but they
would have. Man, it was hot as fish grease then.
It really was, but it was a lot of love, though, because a lot of people from the streets in my community who lived that different life, that hard life, you know, that street life, they wanted to also be in this hip-hop game. And they was very supportive, so that's what was so cool. Wake up in the morning, they were make sure the block was safe so we can break dance, DJ, or do whatever we do, block parties, the whole nine yards. So I'm glad I had those kind of guys to be transparent with what my calling was.
Absolutely. It was definitely necessary because I had the same type of, you know, background, actually, you know what I'm saying? Because most of your gangsters, they got no problem getting busy, but ultimately, they really ain't want no parts of that shit. You know what I'm saying? They will, you know, they would rather really just be doing some positive shit, getting some money. You know what I'm saying?
So
a lot of them will live vicariously through us. You know what I'm saying?
I love how you put that because that's exactly what happened with me. Before the Nipseys and I Smooth 7, Laquan, Corrupt, you know, some just to name a few that grew up with me while I was developing my reputation and skill set until I finally arrived.
Hey, like I said, it was totally necessary. Like, you know, my dudes would always, I'd be hanging with them, and right when they were supposed to go out to the hood, they'd be like, "Yo, we're gonna drop you off."
Man,
we're gonna drop you off and shit. We're gonna drop you off, so we ain't even gonna, you know what I mean, and, you know, involve you, you know, what we about to do right now. Like, We got to, you know what I'm saying?
We got a mission. Exactly.
That, and then it was kind of, for
the curiosity's sake, and when you grew to know them and their parents, as well as going to school with them, you kind of felt like you was left out, you know what I'm saying? Because you just getting to know them and love them and respect, and then the love kick in, and then you be like, dang, man, I need a big brother, because I was the oldest, so I was wondering what some of that the other private time was, you know? I was like maybe 2 or 3 years younger, but once I start understanding what the culture and what the get down was, I was like, oh man, I'm not even built like that to handle that. And it would have shortchanged my lane and just my whole process of how I even think as a human being, you know what I'm saying? Because my mom and dad and uncles had a different perspective about how to protect or physically, you know, be at someone if they was to harm me. But their demonstration was for keepers. They was playing for keeps.
That part.
And I'm like, shit, where no one in the family is an attorney, no family got that kind of bread to put the house up, you know, for bail. So I did good for myself, you know what I'm saying?
At the end of the day, I keep trying to tell these young guys that, you know, being gangster and being a superstar, they don't mix. I say, because for the simple fact, if you gangster, then your whereabouts aren't known. But if you gangster and you got tour dates, then whoever trying to get at you can just pick a date. You feel me? Because your daily schedule is you got a schedule. And they be like, this is where you're going to be at Wednesday. This is where you're going to be at Friday. This is where you're going to be at Sunday. So you can't be out here popping niggas and then go do your show. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like shit, sweet. Like your enemy on your ass. So them two things can't coexist.
Yeah, we seen that from time to time, and time again, man. And now in the fact that you can't hide behind nothing because of technology. It's people that live for the drama and love to expose. So they don't give you enough time to figure that out. They figure like, okay, well, nigga, you can put this out here. You must can deal with the repercussions and everything that come with it. Which fuck up the G-code or what that walk of life is that don't have a lot of benefits versus someone who's in the entertainment. So that's why it was amazing to see how certain people survived. You know, it's a lot of us that can tell it. And write a book about it if not do a movie. But I love this platform because it's from a musician point of view, right, in the eyes of what we lived, breathed, seen, and anything else you could think of.
Yeah, pretty much that we already endured already. So we giving you game from experience, not from no hearsay. Not, you know what I'm saying? Because we both have been in some intense sessions where the drama is thick in the session. You know what I'm saying? Like, somebody could die here today in this session or at this video shoot. You know what I'm saying? Like, we've been there one hair out of place. Somebody's dying today. You know what I'm saying? And it's a tense. Like, you cut it with a knife. You know what I'm saying? See, and that shit ain't fun to be around. You know what I'm saying? Like, you ain't really... Like, you really want to be in the presence of that shit on a daily basis. So niggas want to be gangsters. When you get around some real gangsters that play for keeps and about their business, then you really understand what that texture is like. It ain't something you want to be fucking with on a daily basis. That's for sure.
Yeah, it's amazing that how you put that out there, because when I look at Daz and I look at all the musicians, Superfly, Jimmy Roach, Butch from Parliament, or just anyone who ever came through that whole Death Row experience, how they was able to be focused, spirited, whatever their go-to energy was, how they was able to still make great music through those kind of environments. And it's another thing to be in the room with an audience who was a fan of music, mm-hmm. and or having the consumer ear, like, you know, people who don't do music, but people who support music by going to concerts, record shops, you know, promoting the track, playing it on the answer machine, you know, all the formats that we had, how music was being received. Right. For them to come and sit in the studio and watch this, I can appreciate that kind of audience more than the ways of the world as far as the streets activities. That shit didn't move me too much, and I'm glad that I didn't have that kind of environment, even though I had a few people who was attached to that walk of life, but they knew better to bring in that, because if I had to bring a gun just to have fun with music, that shit just didn't feel right to me. So, and then going to other communities where this different nationality and different energy, it was night and day from where I come from. So I knew I didn't need to bring a gun, because you're talking about people that you're paying money to another entity, and you don't even know their background. They got family that's sheriffs and feds or whoever you can think of. So my thing was, like, shit, if I don't know the law and the jurisdiction in the other community where I'm at, I need to come clean as possible and make sure that I warn my crew to leave that mentality in the neighborhood, but keep the spirit and the energy of the grind and the happiness and maybe a little bit of the triumph and pain of what you've been through in the form of penmanship and on your artistry side, because I'm still going to need that to be transparent in Beverly Hills or Santa Monica or Glendale or COVID City, where I'm just naming a few communities where a studio has been.
Right.
Where I knew Negroes had to come still dressed in the apparel of the G Life, but they knew they had to come with a corporate free spirit, but yet themselves mentality to be able to coexist in a Jew or a white man facility, because there wasn't a lot of black owners in Hollywood of studios.
Oh, at all. So, yeah. Speaking of that, what was the recording process like for Banging on Wax?
Ooh, wait. You cold for that one. Yeah. I'm going to try to make that short and descriptive as I can, but effective.
Right.
Two gentlemen, David Lindley, a.k.a. Cluso, and my boy Tweety Bird, was definitely instrumental. It's another gentleman, too. His name is Red Rum. He was on the Blood side. But Tweety Bird and Red Rum came with a unique idea to try to help change the narrative of what America look at, how they look at us, how they view us, especially New York. You know, they really didn't believe that it was really gangster shit happening, killings, or anyone connected to rap would be that character. It's the truth that they wasn't. The only realest ones that we knew that was involved, that came from the streets, was Mixmaster Spade, Ice-T, King T, Snoop, 8, and DJ Quick. Just to name a few who I know who had 1 foot in the street and 1 foot in the game. I mean, 1 street in the music, one foot in the streets. That's what I meant to say.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So, one day it they found the place to make this happen, and an executive invested in our time, and it ended up being at the legendary Leon Hayward studio on Crenshaw and Obama in Los Angeles.
That's that sample.
Yeah, it's that Dre, you know, signatured his career with Snoop Dogg, the G thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Bad Mama Jamma, Carl Carlton. Bataran was done there. Leon Haywood co-produced that with Toddy T. That was amazing. So we end up having that same opportunity to have a recording professional setting that a lot of people never seen or heard of. They didn't know it exists so close. We didn't have to go to Pass Wilshire. We was right in the hood. But he had it low. He had an incredible establishment. So, but the day that it happened, he had about maybe seven old guys, maybe in their 50s or 60s. And they was like in different parts, like Lego blocks. I can't even explain, like chess, like scattered here and there, but in trench coats sitting at the piano, one sit by a B3 organ, one sits, you know, because when you first walk in the unit, it's like a, maybe big as a basketball court almost, like as far as the live room, before you even get to the control room. He had a walk-in facility that was just unique. So the Crips and Bloods is in there, but we kind of standoffish, like if you was watching the Warriors, the Bloods on this side, the Crips on this side, we looking at each other. We trench coat up, everybody pistoled up. Niggas got gauges, different type of artilleries, and we didn't know how this thing was going to turn out because it was something that was never heard of. You know, it was no peace treaty. It wasn't none of that in place to have a common ground, but the music was supposed to be the common grounds. But because the two leadership we had that knew both sides, they did a unique job, incredible job in introducing one another. And we had to say what neighborhood we came out of because they were going to eventually hear it on wax anyway. But the thing was to bang on wax instead of each other. And with the success of the record, meaning the business as well, that would have helped change the narrative. And maybe after the second or third album where we would have changed the banging on wax to another title, another movement, if we would have had the success. And the thing was, it's giving an escape for people who come from that walk of life, because we knew the Ice Cubes and all it was telling, being the poster boy or the one telling the story of a real G who lived that life. So no one could tell that story better than them. So, but it was sad that how we had to start off first, genocide rapping against each other, you know what I'm saying? But they had to get that off so people can understand the culture and the lifestyle. And it was a success because it was the same time when Dre and then was working on The Chronic. We dropped before The Chronic, if I'm not wrong. So we was number one before they was, which was amazing, because Suge Knight really wanted that kind of somewhat environment. That kind of performance or element in what he was doing, because he really had Crips to support and certain musicians and rappers who come from a blood life, but it was no blood rappers at that time. So he understood the movement because he'd been knowing Dre for so long. But just to speed it up, it landed me with a unique human being named Tyler the Cat out of Long Beach named Domino, Sean Ivory. And so that's what I got out of it. You know, we had Jim Brown, Pam Grier, Avion, Jack in the Box, all of them sponsored the movement. And see, we wasn't even educated to know what our value was. We didn't know that was the first experience and opportunity to get corporate America behind what we was doing, because they felt like, damn, if y'all might have the answer. That's how they was looking at it. Like, if y'all can change that shit in California, where this shit originated at in the first place, we would love to push this to a whole nother level. So we ended up doing a television show, which was a reality show. I wouldn't say reality show, but it was like an Oprah Winfrey. It was called Maury Povich Show. So,
Maury Povich.
Yeah, man. So the people ended up trusting the process to bring a few of the Bloods and a few of the Crips to come up there and try to really educate people and express why this album came together, what was our backgrounds, and what do it mean to the society to take serious? How could they be educated about it? How could they get behind it and support it? How could the LAPD and the sheriffs and DAs and public pretenders, how could they all look at this to see if it could be an answer for what it was? Well, it did as much as it could. We weren't really educated about all that coming at us so fast.
Right.
But it was an incredible ride. It set me up for success, not knowing that Domino was going to be there. And his passion and his drive was beyond that. But he took a chance and put himself on the front line. So he represented Long Beach for the Crip side. And that was amazing before Snoopy actually came all the way out as an artist, representing him out of Long Beach as a gangbang member / superstar, because that's just what he was. So I'm just glad that opportunity happened, because that's how I was able to get my voice and feet wet as a producer.
I had the promo of Sweet Potato Pie.
Oh shit, the cassette promo.
No, I had the vinyl.
Oh, the vinyl? Come on, baby.
I still got it, though.
Oh, man, we talking about analog before digital. Yeah. Right.
So I remember, the first time I heard that and hearing how crispy, I'm like, who the fuck crispy up this breakbeat like that? Just hearing that breakbeat. No, that was actually the same breakbeat from You Got a Flow, Joe. You know what I'm saying? From Fat Joe. You know what I mean? But your shit just sounded way cleaner, because whatever you had on top.
Well, now listen. Now, if you talking about Sweet Potato Pie, let me give you the Chinese secret. First of all, it was Sly and the Family Stone, same break that Dre used to do Deep Cover for One.
Right.
Which was sing a little song. And then the bass line in the music was from SOS Band, produced by Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis, Take Your Time, Do It Right. Then we got Karen Wheeler from Back to Life, looped in the background. And then we got another vibe from Roger Troutman called It Really Doesn't Matter. And
hold on, what was the other one though? 1, 2, 3,
man. Now that's Masquerade. That's actually
That's what I'm thinking about. That's
Sweet Potato Pie. Yeah. So that record is inspired by George Benson, Masquerade.
Okay.
Believe it or not. And I still end up using the same drum break that I'm talking about, because I used that drum break 4 times on that album on all of the singles. which was crazy. He worked 4 times. Just right. Switched up the snares and kicks and percussions on all of them. But if you go back and listen, it's going to fuck your head up to hear the same drum loop 4 times on different records. So we couldn't actually. It was funny how, well, Matt, that was the first hit record, right? How they didn't want to pay for that. Well, maybe it was a lot of red tape to get clear, but they paid for everything else. So I had to understand Greedy Greg and Anti-Ty's hardship that they had to go through to get samples cleared. I really didn't understand that part of it just yet.
Right.
So, but it was cool, because what it did was force me and Rod Bacon, who played on Quick's second album, I had him play live bass and live guitar over it. And I just imitated the same stab right before the verse dropped on Masquerade, and took out the sample.
So I never asked you, but you had to. Did you play it in church?
Yes. Thanks to my cousin Jimmy Taylor.
This nigga know too many chords, man, not to have been in that church at least one time.
But you know what? Having that ear and seeing the culture of church helped a lot. If I didn't live the culture of church, it's some people who are special to be able to reduplicate and still play it well or incorporate it. But I'm glad I lived it, because it was an attitude. It was a walk of life to be spirited in everything that you do in life. So that helped a whole lot to be able to be transparent and take someone like Domino, who could sing, church boy himself, got church boy tendencies, kind of like, not in a funny way, but just the mannerism and melody approach and soulfulness and how he sing. I'm like, okay, we got a lot in common, so we're gonna have to incorporate certain things lightweight that has that soul spirited church thing, but yet keep it hip hop and street as possible, because we knew we couldn't just go all that way, all gospel, but the soul of it helped, you know, from the chops, from choir rehearsal, learning when to play, how to play, or even them letting us use, you know, church, bring jazz and a little bit of funk and a little bit of hip hop into to the church. Now, I started playing drums in the church maybe like 82, 83.
Right.
But not too far apart. We talking about 79, here comes Sugar Hill Gang. So from 79 to 80, 83, 84 was just enough for me to say, you know what, I understand this, I understand that, now let me integrate it together and find an artist or fuck with an artist who got that kind of background, and that helped a lot. Even with Corrupt, it was the same way.
Oh, that was one of my favorite records you ever did. Was the Corrupt joint when the same album was on together.
Man, that part and that kicked me in the ass, because as much as I get on people about not reading credits and the album covers, when you start getting your feet wet and you're the one making the music, you're not really always. I wouldn't say for me, I had so much great things going on. I'm like, I'm making the name now, and I ain't got to look at the credits no more. I know what the music is. I live the culture.
Right.
And from time to time, I would read, because it was just the fundamental things to do when I wanted to dig a little deep into what I'm doing in the art of cooking or making music. If I wanted to really research what I'm looking at, I would do that. But in the later years, I stopped doing that and not saying, okay, well, who is this other guy that's on the album?
Right.
And then so it started kicking me in the ass when I had to go back and find out that Bink Harrell was smashing it with me this whole time and holding the integrity of the album up as much as I was. So I'm hearing Girls All Pause and I'm like talking to Corrupt like, hey, check this out. This is when you on the next album.
Yeah,
I'm like, what is going on? Why is it another nigga banging like this? Is this nigga from Cali? Because he got it. He got too much going on in a good way, where he's seasoned. He's seasoned. I'm thinking, you know, you got your little ego a little bit. Like, I'm supposed to only be the only nigga seasoned like that. But I humbled myself. Because there was another humble beast coming up, and it's my guy who I'm talking to, and I'm like, oh my God, this nigga got to be a drummer. He got to be able to pop lock or something. He got to know how to match. He got to know how to match to some broads or something, because it's too much attitude and charisma and swag and talking shit in a sense in the track. Why is this beat like this? I'm like.
That means so much coming from you, because trust me, when I heard We Can Freak It, I was like, I got some work to do. That's the first thing I said, like, yeah, I got some more learning to do, you know what I mean? Which is a good thing, because that's how I felt when I did Don't Leave with Teddy. You know what I'm saying? When I did the Black Street Sheet with Teddy, it was like, once I brought the idea to him, And then I went back to the studio and just watched him redo it. I was like, yeah, I got a lot to learn. Like, I'm watching him re-cook this motherfucker over, you know what I'm saying? And,
don't leave me, girl. Oh, my
Yes, sir. God. You know what I'm saying? So I'm like, hold up, man. Wait a minute. Like, this man just made my idea sound insane. Well, shout out to Bunny the Barge, because she's the one who wrote that one.
Yes.
For the Barge. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, Bunny, just the chords alone on that record. I mean, just the Barge and Switch alone. Just their chord progressions are just like unheard. Like, you don't, who thinks of this shit? You know what I'm saying? That's what I'm thinking of. Like, who would think to go to that chord from that chord? It's like so unique. You know what I mean?
You're right. But it's funny that you say that, because that kind of chord progression in music theory is not heard enough, and it brings so much hope and joy in the music. And the topic that went with it, you feel me? That's, I miss that. I don't know one play that style. Not to say that we need to go back and wear that chord progression out, but it's funny that you said it, because literally someone put me back in contact with El DeBarge, and I never forget when I had the Ghetto Jam record out. You know, the legendary, great legendary executive in my monster he is behind education and finding great talent, Mr. Harry O, provided me a facility in Glendale, and it happened to be a studio where Chucky Booker reside at.
Woo!
And
another monster.
And so I'm looking, the owner's like, let me talk to a couple of the musicians in this building, because he had a couple of rooms to see if they could maybe open up and share a room with you and their equipment for a month or two. And because he was already on me, Chucky Booker, and he knew who Harry O was behind the Death Row, he wasn't afraid, and he said, man, sure, you got your own equipment, and if not, you know, you can use some of mine. So this is my first time laying eyes on this brother. And when I did the second day, Chico, the Bars, had just got out. Harry O helped him and facilitated him and made sure he was safe and had a home so he could be safe. So next thing you know, the third day, all of the Bars come down to the studio, bro, to come function with me. This shit just blew my mind. And then Chucky Booker comes back and see them all, and they laughing like, oh, man, big brother Chuck. And it was just a beautiful thing to watch L and all them sing and play keys, and they playing shit like Q from Quincy Jones that's on the Brother Johnson's album. And I'm like, right. Oh my God, okay, I understand why The Root is so cold, because they dared to study everything under the sun and didn't leave nothing out. So when they had to create their own sound, they had enough understanding and theory about how they wanted to be just that infectious with their contribution.
Yeah, shout out to Chico, that's my guy. Me and Chico spent a lot of time together on the East Coast.
Man, he's so street in the hood. Oh, man. Oh, I love that dude. Oh, I had a good time with him, man. Waking up in the morning with him for breakfast.
Yeah.
And just seeing him always snapping in between, because he, you know, if it wasn't a drum machine going, he's snapping in between playing chords and singing. I'm like, oh, my God.
That's Chico.
Oh.
That's Chico.
Yeah, that's the guy.
Yeah, that was definitely my guy. What else? Why am I catching a blank right now? When you did all this, hold on. Now that he asked you, if as long as you had your own equipment, what was in your possession at the time? Was it the SP-12? Was it the MP?
We're talking about the great. Early 90s, when this is jumping off, we talking about 94, 95. So in the year of 94, it's going into 95. It's 95. Let's say 95, early 95. This brother that sold me my first equipment. So, yeah, it's the same equipment that I end up using to do Domino album. So at Nadine's next to Paramount is where I bought my equipment at. Dre just left the building. Dre was on the showroom floor with the 3000. Then here come Quick, using the same MPC 3000. I'm in another room, but didn't know. So he slipped past me. We're talking about Quick in the same day. He said, yeah, you want to test out the drum machine? DJ Quick and Dre was just on this drum machine. I already knew what I wanted to get and wanted to try it out anyway. I said, can I buy that one? He said, wait a minute, you sure? I said, there's nothing wrong with it, right? He said, no, we just opened it up out the box maybe like, you know, a couple of days ago before they came. I said, I want that one. So I still have that 3000 that made all my hits that they was fucking with. So I had an MP3000. I had an SB1200 already. But right. after hearing the Chronic during the riots, I said, I need some more equipment. I'm only got 10 seconds in a mono sampler drum machine. I can only go so far.
Right.
So I don't want this interview to sound like I'm Dre jocking, but Dre and Lonzo is the reason why I even discovered or land my eyes and ears on the SB1200. The day that Dre left to form NWA, it was the same day that another friend of mine, Richie Rich from LA, the LA Dream Team, took me up there to do an audition to take Dre's place. And right. that same day, Dre showed me how to work the SB12. So I got familiar with that. I didn't even know how to do time signature or copy to make the beat longer so I could do all my ideas. But I'm playing drum cadence and rudiments on the pad. And Dre is like, man, you sound like you know what you're doing. So short story, he showed me how to use that. So I knew that I was going to get either that or whatever that was on the market. I'll go to right. Nadine, it's the SB1200. I get that. I had that. But when it's time to get all the equipment, I end up getting a 3 MPC 3000, an M1, a JD800, and the Juno 106.
Ooh, the Juno and the M1. M1 is an R&B classic.
Man, when I had a D50 too that someone sold me, and I can't believe I sold mine to DJ Quick, and then he used the flutes on Let the Rhythm Take You on Second to None album. I'm like, oh man, I didn't fucked up. I just sold pieces of equipment that had distinctive sounds because all the Al B. Sure early years, that first, the Kyle West, where, is that his name?
Kyle West.
Yeah, yeah. That was the keyboard that he used for all those legendary sounds. And even the first Guy album was that keyboard as well. So, like I said, those were the keyboards I had. Oh, wait a minute. One more thing. The JD800, the M1, the JD800 was cold. JD800, the M1, the Juno 106, SB1200, and an MP3000.
The JD 100, that's a Roland too, right?
Yeah, that's a Roland. Oh my
yeah,
god!
Yeah.
Programmable keyboard.
Yeah, Mario Winans had that joint.
Man,
he was another keyboard geek. Like,
yeah,
all these different keyboards and all the analog keyboards you can name in his session.
Well, what the unique thing about having all those keyboards, because I had a unique early on experience, not to go into the story, but because of Howard Johnson, the legendary singer who makes So Fine, produced by Kashif, he let me use his Mini Moog. And that Mini Moog Model D don't have no presets. You got to make it yours.
That's right.
So by me playing the shit out of Knee Deep or Cutie Pie or any of those records, I learned how to program them. But I didn't have nothing to write on. I knew I couldn't write on his keyboard. So I just memorized how I set each knob to make the patch. So when I got those keyboards that I'm telling you about, that's what made me so advanced quicker than others in my community, in my neighborhood, on the art of programming sounds. Because I started off being that nasty ass, I gotta make this sound mine. That's cool, I got the preset, but then I started appreciating how to turn the knobs at the same time.
Tweet those envelopes.
Yeah, the envelopes, all that frequency, everything. Frequency was my favorite thing. That the opening close of the frequency.
Yeah, that right. That's why people used to love that SC1.
Oh man, I still got mine. It's behind me right now. The SC1.
Man, right beside me.
Oh man, we was talking about that last time we chopped it up. The Novation Nova rack mount, the ATC1, the 2080. And a TR rack. That module behind me is what made the Weak and Freaky.
Now the TR rack is what I use for my bass I think it was 1-900 Hustler. CO5 was the program number, CO5.
Damn, you giving up some gang right now. That's nice.
It was either CO5 or CO6. One of the two. And that's what I did. That's what I did Girls on Pause with. The TR rack.
It feel like it could, the guitars.
Yeah. The guitars came from 5080.
The 5080. Yeah. That is rolling. That is. Yeah, that's rolling.
5080.
So you had the 5080 or the 3080 by then?
No, I had the 5080.
Woo!
I still got that right here too, with all the cars in it still. 60s and 70s car, orchestral car, effects car, bass car.
Man, I think that is so vital and a passionate thing for us to hold on to the sounds of that era and time, because when we want to go create that, it's nothing like electricity going through a hardware versus a software.
Absolutely.
The way it's wired, the way the motherboard is that whole vibration, it's electricity going through that thing. Software, it's just a powered computer in the software. But
that part. But that's where the horns come from Rollers back, 5080. On the Jay-Z shit, that's the same shit, 5080. That's
that's
the 5080. So it's like, bruh, I would never get rid of something that sounds good.
What was that like for you to buy those type of modules? And then attracting people like Jay-Z and whoever else that's been under your crazy library or arsenal of hits. What was it like buying equipment like that? I mean.
Well, the thing about me, bro, is like, I've always been a gear snob. You know what I'm saying? So every check I got, I'm a guitar center. You know what I'm saying?
Man, like a strip joint. I gotta go see what's the latest chick in this store.
Yeah, that part. Like every time my soul a beat, I make guitar center, Jack. You know what I'm saying?
It's one other special spot in LA where we went to.
Sam Ash.
Not just Sam Ash. Before Sam Ash, it's called Black Market. Los Angeles, where they sold all the original B3s, the Mini Moogs, all that. Oh my God, I'm talking about 10 Mini Moogs, different Roses, different Wurlitzers. I'm talking about anything analog, B3s, Prophets, the shit Stevie Wonder was using, Synclavs, bass,
they gone,
drums.
Man?
Yeah, they've been gone, man. That place right there was like how we were used to go to Record Finders, which was on Melrose and Larchmont, where Dre got all his records from. That's right. His catalog came from that man. Kevin, I want to say Kevin Donovan or something like that.
Eventually, I started going to Amoeba.
Yeah. See, they came a little later, and I ain't mad at them.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had a whole bunch of spots on Melrose that we would go to. Me, Jinx, Far Side, Slip from NWA. I mean, not NWA, from Compton's Most Wanted. Vibe Cat Pool. We would all go. I think it was called Street Sounds. I could be wrong, but I think that was one of the Street Sounds was one of the golden places we would go to. Upstairs, downstairs, had the turntables already there. I know a nice receiver in front of it where you can put the needle, drop the needle, and play it. Oh, we loved that. I think it was Street Sounds.
We went to Sound Library and A1 on the East Coast in New York.
Damn.
Those are the
Sound Librarian A1.
Yeah, we stayed up in there. You know, one record would be $150.
Yeah, see, yeah.
$75, like, you know what I mean? Like, but Jesus. No matter where I worked at, like, you know what I'm saying? When I was working in Miami at Circle House, I used to go to this other record store out there, and this dude used to collect lunch boxes from school. Remember the school lunch boxes?
Yeah, classic shit.
Like Groovy Ghoulies and goddamn.
Yeah, classic, like, authentic shit. Like, yeah.
Yeah, all these different lunch boxes going. I can't remember the name of the spot was, man. I'm mad as shit. But everywhere I used to go work at, I would go dig for records for about 2 hours before I even go to the session. You know what I'm saying? That was just something I did every time. Nothing to talk about.
Now, we're talking about records. Well, you still found some gems that was less expensive. But I know that was a mother taking a chance on the record at 70 something. $100 to $100 something, and it might not be shit on it, unless you the kind of guy that ain't totally relying on a full loop. You could just take a millisecond of a sound and flip it.
That's me. Once you hear the original sample to Ruler's Back, then you get it. Or All I Need, then you get it. You know what I'm saying? Like, All I Need is a chord progression to inspire something else. Like, I was at a halal stand in New York one time, 6th Avenue. Found a rap and shit, Gyro. And the dude was playing the Iranian music, you know what I'm saying? From over there, Saudi Arabia type shit, with the strings and all that. Mm. So, you know, that's why they all were from and shit. So I'm like, listening. I heard the string line, I'm like, yo, bro, I'm like, you know, how much you send me that tape for? He's like, no. I got this from Flushing. Like Flushing Queens. I'm like, man, I ain't finna go away to Flushing Queens. I said, bro, I'll give you $20 for that tape. He's like, no. I ended up going all the way up to $100. When I said $100, I heard another string line. I said, man, I'll give you $100 for that tape right now. He popped that bitch out so fast, hit that eject button. Here you go, my friend. And that joint ended up going on State Property album.
Wow. And,
Yeah,
I can't, man. Yeah. You quadruple your money back.
That part. So I was like, yo, I gotta have this. Now, you know, plus it was some music I wasn't familiar with. You know what I'm saying? Because their keyboards are tuning a whole other scale. You know what I mean? It's a whole different, you know, scale that they're on. So it's like to hear these string lines that they were doing. I was just like, man, this just sounds crazy the way they bending the string and just the chord they're in. Like, I don't even know what chord they're in right now. Like, this is different. So it's a song
called
What's the National? It was an Arabian record.
Arabian, see, we talking, yeah. See, and that's amazing how you was able to put your VA, you know, Virginia.
Oh, I thought it out. That's for sure.
Yeah, how you was able to put bring two cultures. See, this is what I be sharing with people: the magic in bringing two different cultural backgrounds. Nationality, race, whatever you want to call it, how to put two different walks of life in the same room. And that's just like when you're traveling and you seeing Arabics, you seeing someone from Ireland, someone from Jamaica, someone from France, but then you start to mesh each other's cultural sounds together. That I think is so freaking amazing, because it's a universal language to get people to commune with one another, talk, you know, express right. themselves and appreciate each other's cultures. That's what this music should always be. So the fact that we went and did that, was inspiring to do that, I'm pretty sure whoever was really listening that knew that, hey, that's our music, you know, for you having a string line, but then they never heard the bottom end like that before. So it gave them a different appreciation, not only for the culture, but the race.
Right.
That, you feel me? That's what music.
Put some paint where it ain't, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, man.
Put some paint where it ain't, you know what I mean? So it's just always, you know, it was always dope to listen to records and just be like, wow. Like, you know, you hear how this horn stabs or the string stab. Well, like I said, a lot of these kids now, when they listen to samples, not even understanding, okay, what am I listening to right now? I'm listening to a Rose with a chorus reverb on it, with a phase wah, you know, with a phaser, with a wah-wah on it, all this shit going on at the same time. But they looking for that actual sound. Not understanding they can create that sound themselves. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, so that's another thing. That's why this platform is so incredible, that they, to teach them to be more tenacious. Nosy is another word for it as well. My wife taught me the word tenacious. Always asking questions. And once you, and the thing is to ask an engineer that. Ask of someone who's running the studio, what is this? What type of effect is that? I hear some other things going on, and I hear that it's a string, but what else is that? And I think the more that they can get more in tune with what that is, like you said, they will have the appreciation in the art of sound designing and having their own identity in the sound that they're inspired by, and making it do something else unimaginable. You know what I'm talking about?
Once you can identify what you're exactly hearing and how they got it that way, then, you know, it's just a whole nother space in your brain opens up. You know what I'm saying? Like, real shit. Like, that's why I was like, most of these kids don't even know what they're sampling. They just sample something that sounded dope, but they wouldn't know how to recreate this sample within the record.
Yeah, see, and that helped you go a long way, too, because if you got a job description and scoring something, you would need to know the language or terminology or whatever, or the history of it to be able to do so. Because I've been in situations where, like Lady of Rage, and them, they wanted instrumentals of records that they never had. Dre got the masters, but I end up going to whosampled.com and pulled up one of Dre's records that she was talking about. And right. It broke down for them to take the time out to know what records he used to make every intricate part of that track. It's exactly what I did. But I still understood the frequency, the swag, the accent, the tone, everything about what Dre did. And I recreated it for her in RBX, like Stranded on Death Row. It's not out. You can't get that nowhere.
No, listen, I peaked the game doing the verses.
No, wow. Sorry, I peaked the game doing the verses. Look, you're a bad man. I like how you sped that up. You're a cold host.
Like, hold on. Like, wait a minute. Like, hey, I'm listening to verses with you and Snoop. I'm like, now, wait a minute. Man, no instrument up that song.
Which is Pump Pump.
Man, a lot of joints. I'm just like, man, this dude battles it. Is a fucking genius, bro. Like, the way he can recreate something and you not even understand it's being recreated. Like, you don't hear a hole in it at all. Like, people will redo something, but you hear where they cut it, where they, you know what I'm saying, where they...
Yeah, spliced it. Yeah, yeah. It's not splice. Organic. Yeah, you don't hear what's the word?
The continuity of it.
Continuity, goddammit, continuity.
Yeah, it stays the same. The consistency of the whole record. It's like, man, I said, this dude is a... But at the same time, a lot of people listening to it, not even paying attention, not understanding the work that shit entail.
It's funny how the people said I was the cheat code.
You were. But, You were.
I gotta laugh about that because I don't even like the word cheat next to me because I'm so authentic and real. But I get it though.
It was authentic cheat. It was authentic cheat though. You know what I mean?
Okay, so me and you are letting everyone know that cheat is good if it's authentic.
It's authentic because the thing is, only reason why people said it was cheating was because it wasn't there. Like, these instrumentals weren't there. And to take the time to recreate these songs, to have the instrumentals, it was a cheat code that was not illegal. You know what I'm saying?
Hey, at least my bro is over here co-signing. So whoever's looking at this, you got one of my G's, one of my bros. Yeah. I love, I respect as a musician and as a man to say that because I know you can't stand a motherfucker that bite and cheat. Ooh. Ooh. That thing right there. I know you wish you could put your dukes up with a bunch of these niggas.
Hey, and the thing is, you know, and to me, when it comes to cheating, it's like. It's just like writing, like a guy who doesn't write raps. It's only corny when he doesn't say somebody wrote it.
See, you know what? If we could get the rest of the world, you already know where I'm at. We need someone to govern what's going on, and they cannot enter any platform of music if they don't have this. These true gems we share. See, we didn't have no gatekeepers of that to police that or give consequences, repercussions. Now it's like anything goes. That shit really hurt the game because they made it where if we not that, then you ain't shit.
There's no rules, man. There's no principles. You know what I'm saying? There's no principle that the morals, the integrity is super low. If any at all, you know what I'm saying? So it's like I just seen somebody talking about some white kid invented chopped and screwed, like slowing down the beat. It's like, yo, are you serious? Like, are you serious? He's doing it again now. So people was like, yo, you screw, that's DJ Screw. Like, what are you talking about? Like, how can you skip screw and start giving this guy the credit. For chopping screw? Like, It's so crazy now that, you know, people just take things and don't pay homage.
It almost makes you want to change the amendment. with some repercussions behind it.
You know what I mean?
It's too much freedom of something with no consequences. But hey, you know what? I think what we got going on right now, it's going to be crazy when someone look at this 5 years from now or 10 years from now. It's going to be, or even when it's all edited and done, it's going to be crazy when they look back at this. Because this is what makes us so relevant. And this is what have people that are young respect. It's like the Mike and Keys and the Ren Stops and From 1500 to Nothing, Mars, just to name a few. Terrace Martin or whatnot. They really get it. And I just think it's important, man, that people hear this information because everyone wants to know why the music is not doing what it's doing.
Because the influence, not to cut you off, but the influence of corporate America. The influence from corporate America tends to blur lines. You know what I'm saying? Because they turn everything into an assembly line, cookie cutter. You know what I'm saying? They just want you to bring them the same record without bringing them the same record. If you can figure that out, then they all for it.
They got a check for you.
Yeah, they're not into anything being innovative. They don't spend money on innovation. You got to go out here and prove that what you're innovating is that shit first before they come up with the check. Like, for instance, Miguel. The Adorn record. He brought that to the label. They was like, nah, that ain't it. He's like, okay, cool, I'll put it on my mixtape. Put on the mixtape, it went nuts. Same thing with Usher's, yeah. They told Lil Jon, this ain't it. Lil Jon went straight to the radio. Absolutely was it. Broke Beatles records. You see what I'm saying? So we got to understand that corporate America never knows because it's not their culture. It's our culture.
Yeah. We don't have anyone authentic like Berry Gordy, who was a CEO and got it and understood it.
Right. They understood like he was in the trenches. But most of these people are just people with the money.
But at least in this documentary, or a few I saw, at least he manned up and said that he was wrong when Stevie Wonder had, or Marvin Gaye had a record, like What's Going On, and he felt like that wasn't it and that wasn't the record. At least he manned up and said that on his own, that he said I was wrong. And I admit to that. I'll be a man about that. That's one thing I love about him as the CEO, as in corporate America. He, as a black man, stood up and admitted his, his wrong in another man's vision and passion. See, when it comes from a person's heart, we're not supposed to be second guessing that. The thing is, it's just trusting. They always tell us to trust the process. They always say, be ambitious, be creative. Where that's not, if it's good and it's pure, it shouldn't have to be questioned so much.
Right. I tell the kids all the time, dare to be different.
Yeah, bro.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Dare to be different and have the audacity to know your worth.
Yeah, you know see, that's it. Those the two key right there. So, those you know, I ain't got nothing else good to say in the end, but thank you for putting me, having me a part of this, even though you might have a few more questions. But what you just said right there is what I'm, that's it. That's how I feel.
I mean, bro, like I said, I try to instill the old principles in the new guys. But the downside to that is, most of these kids come into the game without knowing what integrity is. So the things I may say may annoy them because they don't have the principles laid out for them to say, hey, be creative. Don't cheat off his paper. Do your own thing. You know what I'm saying? Like, anybody could take a blank piece of paper and put it over top of somebody else's art and trace it.
I used to see that shit too. Does that make you an artist?
You know what I'm saying? That doesn't make you an artist. You're a tracer. So at the end of the day, it's like, right. So you can't sit here. And some people have been tracing their whole career. They made a career out of tracing. And if that's as far as your integrity goes, then knock yourself out. But I don't want to play some music and the first thing you say, well, that reminds me of Babyface. But that reminds me of Teddy. Like, I don't want you to say that.
Yeah, because now that you're not important. They don't appreciate you. They don't, you know, they looking at another man's accolades again, and it's like it puts you in the back. Puts you in the back seat. It puts you in an ugly space. It puts you as a biter. It take you out of the title, the true titles of something organic and authentic or original or refreshing, yeah. Unique.
When you hear Weekend Freak It, you like, that's Battle Cat.
Yeah.
Ain't nothing to talk about. Like, that sound like Battle Cat. Like, he ain't thinking about nobody else. Now, you may hear the influences of, like, Parliament, shit like that, or fucking Roger Troutman.
You may hear
some influences here, some nuances here and there, but overall, the swing and how you put your shit together, this is Battle Cat. Like, nobody makes Reason sound like this that I know of other than Battle Cat. That's what me and Mike and Key talk about all the time. How you make Reasons talk. Like, that shit is like, we still can't figure out what the hell you're doing, but you're doing something different. You know what I'm saying? They make that bitch sound so clean, and all the sounds always have their own space. You know.
I got to step outside and look at that too, because that's another thing to know, that it's a human being behind it, and I walk away, and I listen to it. You know how you might have your door open, like how I seen you went to go open another door. I love walking away from something that I created so I can have a different ear and a different perspective as a consumer or a teacher or a customer. I mean, a student, a consumer, or a fan. I always have to have that in mind, because producing by yourself sometimes can be a gift and a curse.
Right. And
I say that because you're only so good in what you choose to be around or what you listen to.
Right.
And so I remember Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis telling me when I first met them through the Avila brothers, Bobby and Izzy, they said, "Hey boy, you sound hella good and hella great and funky as hell. But remember this too. You need to sit with someone that will challenge you as well. Because that's the only way you're gonna know where you really stand and what you really have to offer in this thing called music." Meaning, you don't want to be redundant and complacent. You know,
right.
Because for them, they were still in that, like, we're searching and looking for that. Who got whatever next? We know where we come from, and we know what hip-hop is, but we still looking for someone who can take where we come from and what you know to another level. So I was loving that, because they wanted to grow. They didn't have no egos. They wasn't on that, nigga, our shit is the shit, and that's what it is. And
you can hear that in their music, bro. Like, they cover so much ground, bro. It's like programming geniuses. You know what I'm saying? Like, their program game is like no other, man.
Well, you got records like okay, when Teddy did his thing, I love how they was inspired by the swing, but they found their own fucking sound to match that swag and that swing. Uh-huh. So I didn't think of Teddy Riley when I heard Rhythm and Nation, but I knew they was dead ass right next to greatness, listening to him swing like he was, doing Keith Sweat, doing Guy, doing whoever else. And he would change up the swing with records like Just Got Paid by Johnny Kemp. And just little gems like that said, okay, Cap, you're a drummer, then bring all your time signature game to the table. You say you like jazz, there's so many different styles of jazz. You say you like hip hop, there's so many layers and pillars of that. And so if you're going to be this guy called the producer, you're going to have to be open and challenge yourself with people who's greater than you to turn the fire up under your ass.
That part. And don't dictate what you're doing about what's going on. You know what I'm saying? A lot of people base what they're doing comparing it to what's going on rather than what they feel and what they hear. So, you know what I'm saying? Like, I never let that influence me. Only thing I let influence me is BPMs.
Tempo.
Tempo is the only thing I would let influence me is tempo.
Yes, because, that, yeah, yeah, yeah. Sometimes frequencies too. I can't even leave that out. Tempos and frequencies do it for me. Like yesterday, I was listening to Music Soul Child's album, and I was freaking floored with all those colors.
What, that Carbon and Ivan?
The album where it's the la 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 la. It was so many gems on that album that was kicking me in the ass, but it just took me back to how, like you said, you would look for certain chord progressions to flip, to take another direction. He going back and put my ear on that album did that for me yesterday.
I understand where you're coming from, though. We're coming from the home of Gamble and Huff, Larry Gold, Teddy Pendergrass, you know what I'm saying? Like, that's the home of Philly.
Philly slash Detroit, because he's between that and Stevie Wonder big time.
Core-wise. But I'm just saying, just the musicianship. Philly breed boxers and musicians. You know what I'm saying? All day. You know what I'm saying? So to hear the musicianship on his album, Music Soul Child's album, it just makes sense. You know, Dre and Vidal is from Philly. You know what I'm saying? If you ever listen to, what's my man's name, man? Glenn Lewis. You ever listen to Glenn Lewis
fucking
album?
Lewis. Yes, yes.
Yeah, jeez. That's Dre and Vidal produced that whole thing. You know what I'm saying? So live strings and live flutes and all type of shit.
So when you say Dre, it's two guys. So Andre
Harris.
Okay.
And Vidal Davis. You know what I'm saying? That's two of my allies right there. But they also produced Butterflies for Michael Jackson.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Caught up for Usher and, you know, all types of shit. But the instrumentation on Glenn Lewis' album is like, you know, because they shared the studio with Larry Gold. So having Larry Gold at your disposal is like, that's next level. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I'm going to watch a documentary on Curtis Mayfield, and they interview one of my favorite composers. God damn, he's the one who produced Shaft in Africa. I can't think of Johnny Pate.
Johnny Pate, yeah. Oh yes, yeah. Johnny Pate, Lord. Show me what you got.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? That come from Shaft in Africa.
Yes.
So he said that Curtis Mayfield would send him a cassette of him singing with the guitar, and he would write all that brass and strings to that.
Man, I love the freak out of brass. See, that's why me and you, we a problem. when we do something, when we score something together and produce.
Speaking
into existence. You see,
that's gonna happen. Yeah, that's gonna happen.
Because I learned from you so much. I said, man, who was inspired by? Because your string game is crazy. And I love Benjamin White and what's his name, Fisher, on the Purple Rain album, the strings he did, and on some Raphael Sadiq shit. And I'm trying to think who was the string arranger on Barry White's shit.
Barry White was.
I get it. He write it out. They play it. I get it.
Right.
I get it. Yeah.
Sheet music. It was called the Love Orchestra.
Yeah, the Lord Orchestra. Yeah.
Love Unlimited. I'm sorry.
Love Unlimited Orchestra. Yeah.
So that was just I never seen any composer credits. It was just him and them guys. You know what I'm saying? So he had that Quincy in them too.
Yeah, he sure did.
But the crazy Quincy. Jewel game.
Quincy is another one. String game code, sir.
Come on, man. Who would know to use a bass harmonica on Sanford and Son intro?
Niggas don't play like that. Nobody play like that no more.
Come on, bro. I was just like, bro. Clown. That's what you call swag. You know what I'm saying? So when you read the back of their records and you see fucking Herbie Hancock on Rose, fucking George Benson on guitar and Bob James on whirling. So he's like, man, God damn, like this was in one session? Like wait a minute.
He
like,
got the best of the best in that room.
The best of the best. And that's what it takes to come up with records like Thriller and Off the Wall. Like, you got to have those type of guys behind the board. You know what I'm saying? It ain't about us playing it. It's about finding the best nigga for the job that can elaborate on our idea and take that shit through the goddamn ceiling. You know what I'm saying?
So that's what happened with records like Pimp the Butterfly. That was a perfect example because right. Terrace Martin brought in the Kamazi Washingtons and the Robert Glaspers and the Thundercats.
Yeah, yeah. Man, the bass line you had before they got there, that was a good idea. But that nigga heard something else too, in addition to
what you did.
That dope ass idea that you had. And that shit was jamming before they got there.
Yes.
You see what I'm saying? It was jamming before they got here.
But now so that's that. Like, that's called not settle.
Right.
That's yeah. It's pushing the envelope, but it's first not settling, and pushing the envelope, and it's a trip. If the younger generation can see that process more often, then they won't settle, and they'll be passionate about doing it. So. Like having this conversation, that why you, I had to say that. I know you're shaking your head because we got a lot of people who don't listen, but some do. Because why you think when I be live on Instagram, they be they can see my expression, if not seeing my fingers. I mean, might not see what modules I'm using, but I think a lot of them can appreciate that they see me going in live before their eyes and going, damn. And I always have to talk a little shit like, please trust the process. This is not a club where you're asking for tunes that I already did to be played. I'm not giving that service. I'm sharing with you an experience you would never have an opportunity to experience, and I'm giving it to you live. See, look, let him see that Fender Rose in the back. See, he earned respect off the back.
You see that, my
man? That motherfucking Fender Rhodes. It's got to be.
See that, man.
Yeah, you feel me? My eyes be hawking for live equipment, Jack.
You weren't supposed to see that, man.
Man. Ain't nothing like hearing a real hammer hitting that cork, hitting them strings. And it's funny how Larry Dunn from Earth, Wind & Fire used to take the felt off of the hammer, and you would hear it hit hard, the hammer hard. And I'm like, how you got your damn Fender Rhodes sounding like that? He used to take the strip off the hammer of the wood hammer that would strike the note. And that's why his Rhodes sound like it did. I was like, oh, if you don't cut it out. And that's when I started appreciating with certain software that really knew what that was about. If you really wanted to create that, you couldn't afford a Fender Rhodes. Like if you're using Omnisphere.
Right.
Or you using some VSTs. You want to compare your software to hardware. So one of my gems is just go to the studio, not making music. Just go there, bring all your software there, and then rent all the hardware versions of the software so you really can see the variations in it. Like you can really start shaping and tuning your software as close as possible to the hardware, then you really in the game. Cause that's called
ABN.
Yeah, you feel me?
It's ABN. You know what I'm saying? Because you never know what it is if you can't put them side by side.
Yeah,
you know, and that's you got to put them side by side.
And that's what I'm kind of glad. And I hope I hear more progression of his music. Meaning Mustard, he's really using hardware along with his software.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? At least he's doing
it. You can hear it good. You can hear he got some resistance in there with him. You can hear it. You hear it. And that's what I love about him, you know, evolving his sound to where it is now. You know what I'm saying? Like, he's not just settling and just doing what he came in the game doing.
Yeah.
You can hear the evolution of him.
Yeah, it's changing. I get it. Because I seen him a few posts of him touching it himself and playing it. I was like, he not disrespecting real musicianship, and he's really sharing with his audience and fans and people who know him or don't know him that he's really touching hard, where he's not just a software cat trying to stay in one lane of the art of creating a sound for his track. I really can appreciate that, seeing all them keyboards around him and him utilizing it. So
he's evolving. He's definitely evolving, but we got a lot of mutual people we done work with, you know what I'm saying? No Exhibit, you know what I'm saying? Like I say, E-40.
Oh, man. That's crazy that you say that, man. Dan, so what record on Exhibit album, for those who's on here that don't know?
I think I was on Man vs. Machine.
Okay. I think I was on that one. I did Criminal Set.
I did the record with him and Anthony Hamilton.
I gotta go put my ear. Damn, Anthony Hamilton.
Yes, listen, that was the first time anybody ever used him. Anybody. I was the first person to put him on a record. It's called Gambler, a song called Gambler.
Damn.
Yep.
I used
Tim Izzo on Fluke on that joint. Same thing I used on Nate Dawg's I Got Love. Same.
Oh man. Yeah. Another classic. Oh, spooks, 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 spooks. That's drummer shit. I'm like, and your drums is not too far away from you either, though. But that's what I'm talking, man. I just love it, man. You're really that guy, bro. I'm excited about that type of shit. I love the fact that someone got a set of drums in the room like I do.
Look, you keep your shit mic'd up ready to go.
It's ready to go, Jack.
You know, that drum, like the drums on Thank God It's Friday, nigga, when the Commodore was playing, nigga, that was like,
yes, man.
That's the church joints. You got to know how to get them heads dead, though.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's a fact. See, that's a lot of gems for you. I'll be understanding, like, getting things to sound to your liking and not to what the standard is.
You are the standard. If you're a brand, you better have a standard about your shit, or it's gonna be a problem. You're not fit to eat. Mm. Or you gonna eat, but you ain't gonna really be respected, you know, like that. You know what I'm saying? I want the respect while I'm eating. I can't have one without the other. You know.
Now, I still ain't got on Snoop album yet. Now, he on my goddamn
hit list. Okay, you know what? I got the project. You already named E-40, right?
Yeah.
With him and another great on this side and another great on the Bay, they just formed as a group. It's four of them.
They gotta be short. Anybody but short?
Yeah. That's it. Look.
Anybody but short,
man. And on this side. And on this side is Ice Cube. All four of them. And they working right now.
I did the theme music for the Big Three. The one with Cube rapping on it.
See what I'm talking about when niggas don't, even a legend like me is supposed to be having my ears to the street like that. Like, okay, who did that? Let me find that out. You feel me? So now, so you finna help me step my who's who game up. I'm supposed to know that. That shit don't feel good. It's wonderful hearing the information, but it don't feel good and not knowing that and saying that on a first name basis, because in this industry, information is key. And if you're gonna have a great conversation with people, you need to embody what's going on in the field that you're in. Who's the who and what's what. Yeah, that's so important. Jesus Christ.
So what did you have to do where I get around?
Well, it was an opportunity to do the remix. And right. Howard Johnson and John McClain at Interscope, who helped discover the Death Row whole movement as well. John McClain, that's my other big bro and sensei of the game, gave me an opportunity to do it. And I did it, and it was amazing hearing what Shock G sound like. I never heard that record break down like that. That brother had Static, he had Impeach the President, he had Computer Love. I just couldn't believe the elements that I was hearing, and I wish I had another crack to do it again, but it was cool because, you live and you learn. But he liked it, and it happened. But, you got, if someone give you an opportunity to do a remix, you better kill it. You better not slacken your shit. Don't do that. So,
especially if it was already a great record, you can't.
Yeah, man.
Come with no bullshit anyway.
Yeah, and it wasn't bullshit, but it wasn't all the way correct to me. And and that's why I say having a partner in the room to challenge you to make sure that you pick the right things, or they challenge you in the art of sound selecting and arranging. So I got another opportunity after that one, and this is when Tupac had to sit down. That's when he had got convicted for the alleged rape case.
Right.
So before he went to death row, he wrote a letter to the record company, but he wrote another part that he wrote two letters. He wrote one to the label, one to me. But I think he wrote another one too to Warren G. Well, he was attempting to. If he couldn't get me to do the remix of Temptation, which is Easy Mo B, another dope fucking producer and brother and right. human being that I respect. I'm coming behind him and pulling his element up. And it was cool. So Shock G and Easy Mo B is the two cats I respect, and I end up doing remixes of their records, and I'm glad I had the experience. And but it was amazing to hear how he felt when he wrote the letter. He had heard so much records, so many records. I had did Cam's record, Yo-Yo record at this time. We're talking about 96. And I'm on the charts. I got like 10 records like in the top 20.
Total Control. The Yo-Yo record was Total Control. That was the album anyway.
Yeah.
One for the cuties, Yo-Yo Funk, Bonnie and Clyde.
Yeah. Look, check him out.
Body work.
Oh, he pulling me up right now, like he at the office trying to close this case.
You feel me?
Detective Bink Harrell.
See, that's crazy. I didn't know you did Bonnie and Clyde. That was.
Now after doing the Tupacs and all that, I knew that if I was gonna do more bounce to the ounce, that I needed to make it count. And
that's
when Cube asked me how much I charge. He cared to ask because the way I was putting it down, he was changing producers, and he wasn't working with the Bomb Squad like he used to. You know, the relationship and him growing and label changing and all that. You know, so he was trying to sniff me out to see was I going to be too expensive. But because Hario taught me my value, I told him $18,000.
Which is nothing at the end of the day. It's nothing.
Yeah. He was like, $18,000? I'm like, man, I do got plaques. I am plaquing. I mean, Yo-Yo got that many. See how many you counted on the album? She kicked it in.
That part. Cause she got what she asked for.
Yeah.
So why wouldn't she kick it in? You feel me?
Yeah, she kicked it in. So I salute to Yo-Yo. She did that. But he came back later and got with me. And I made it affordable because I did a song deal with him, which was cool. I love song deals back in the
90s. We from the street, man. You buy one, you pay the price. You buy in bulk, you love. That's how it go.
You feel me?
That's how it go. So you want to buy in bulk, we take a couple of stacks off. You buy more than one,
exactly. Exactly. Dre did that. He played $1.75 for 10 of them.
Come on, man.
And none of them records came out, and he still breaded me up. I love him for that.
Come on, man. He know was the dope was good. That's it.
Yeah, exactly.
My man got some good dope, so I just want to lock in with him, know I can get some dope from him. And that's all I need to know. That's it. I'm cool. I tell anything else.
Yeah, and he did too, and he was like, wow, like, and I like how it was the situation where, okay, I'm paying you this, but I still need to hear satisfaction. So,
yeah, absolutely.
So I never forget.
You know meticulous.
Yeah, meticulous, like to the 10th power. Oh, God.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I did two song deal with Snoopy like that, and that felt good.
Was that Blue Carpet?
Huh?
Was that the Blue Carpet album?
After the first Eastsiders album, we started doing song deal packages. Because it set that nigga off. He went platinum and independent. The sound set him off. This is his first time without working with Dre. He back in California. So he got the Meat Swells, he's got the Fred Rex, he's got the Battle Cat, and he's got the Black Tovin and Jelly Roll.
First of all, that's the trio for me right there. Battle Cat, Jelly Roll, Superfly. You guys are my favorite three out of the West.
Say that one more time. You said,
Cat, Superfly,
Jelly Roll.
Yeah, those my go tos for West Coast.
That boy Jelly Roll, and I see why you say that with them both, because I didn't been in the room with them both. They both church boys. Oh my God, and they sound is night and day in the original. And you understand that first Dog Pound album, that is Superfly to a T. That chord progression and all that on that work, that Dog Pound album, that is Superfly.
Superfly is that guy, bro.
Then you talking about Jelly Roll. Jelly Roll, it's like, okay, I bring it with me to the studio. He meets Snoopy for the first time. We're working on the Top Dog album, if I'm not wrong. Yeah, the Top Dog. I didn't make the album. Snoopy still paid for the beats. Placed them later. Placed the ones that didn't make it. Both of them went on a Badass album.
Okay.
But my man is with me. Snoopy goes for a break to go get some Roscoe chicken. They come back. But before they come back, I'm just saying, Jelly Roll asked me, is everything saved? I said, yeah. He said, I want to make a beat. Can I get in? Hell yeah. I'm in the lounge. Shoot. He take the same file, same kit that I used from a record I just finished, and was on his temple shit. Snoopy walked back in. What the fuck is that in the room? Because that's what I need right there. I said, I didn't trip. I said, that's my right. Nigga Jelly Roll. He walked in the room, nephew, print that. I need that. Jelly Roll is happy with a little tears in his eyes. I'm like, well, that's what I brought you here for. We want to work. You want to eat. Shine.
Listen, you deserve to be here, champ.
Shine. And the record ended up being Shining Star or Superstar. Superstar, I think. Shining Star. Rolling with a DPG or something like that.
Oh, man. But the crazy thing is, it just shows you, again, it shows how much of a real nigga you are. Because most niggas wouldn't have been able to, their egos wouldn't allow that to happen. Because it would have took the attention off of them.
Yeah, you know they took they shine. It would have took shine off of them. And I wouldn't even want that. I wouldn't want the contingent fee, finer's fee, none of that. I just wanted them to get on because that was just, I think it was his first 3 to 6 months in California for the first time ever from Tulsa. And his brother, Black Tobin, put him on and brought him to Cali. His brother brought him to Cali, but he said to for him, I put him on. I don't really like taking the credit, but I understand what it is. When you want bringing someone to a situation and they own, it's they own. You put them on. But I would never go around saying I put him on. It's not even right. About that. I was just glad that he was a decent human being to want to say that everywhere he went on his own.
That counts
more to me because that's loyalty without trying to train someone or beat it in them or make him say, hey, only way I'm going to get you on unless you tell her, you know, you better not be telling motherfucker, I need you to say this and say that. It wasn't even about that because it's like in that good book when you read in that Bible, God want loyalty. He not going to hold your hand. He want to see where you at. So your choices is going to say a whole lot about how the relationship is going to be when you working with someone. So he showed loyalty, and some people don't appreciate that in California a lot. They feel like you bigging up someone too much, you know.
Yeah.
Don't give them their flowers, you know.
No, cuz.
Yeah, you take the credit for all the time and keep them in the back seat. Like I tell people that all the time, man, no man is your savior, man. Don't put that kind of faith into them like that. Like
that part.
You know what I'm saying?
Well, another album we was on together was Pineapple Annihilators too. BJ Chicago Kid.
You know what? That was a crazy situation. The homie Chords put me in that, and my first time getting on that project was my instrument was turntables.
Yeah, I remember. You put the that's why I say this nigga Battle Cat an asshole. You put the sample in the same key. I'm like, who does that? I think it was Stevie Wonder record or something like that.
Yeah, some Stevie Wonder. Some Stevie Wonder shit. Yeah. A whole bunch of gumball shit, and I'm pulling off the shelf. I just hit the block. He already had a turntable and a mixer there. I didn't even use Serato's or shit that was already sitting in the drive. I just happened to hit the block and use what was in the room.
You knew what song was in the same key off top. You're like, yo.
You feel me? You feel me?
Yeah, yeah. But I had the other side up there. Song called Other Side.
Oh, that's my shit. Oh man.
So this is
indirect divine order.
Right.
You feel me? I said indirect because it wasn't planned out. It was like, are you kidding me? So he from Chicago. He peeping LA producers, DJing. So BJ's like, okay, nigga, where the keys at? You need a keyboard or? Well, shit, it's a lot of shit already done. You just need me to cut, right? Okay, so I'm pulling. He's sitting down. He watching the experience. I'm just pulling. Oh, yeah. I'm not even telling him what I'm pulling. I'm just pulling off the wall. Okay, yeah, give me the key. And he in there losing his mind like, you know how dogs be so happy when you come in the house, they're happy to see their mask. That nigga running around the whole studio like, I can't believe he's making this shit go just on some damn turntables. But it's the musicianship and musicality of or understanding all the history of music that I fell in love with. I knew where he was going because he was already, it was a war record. The world is a ghetto produced by Jerris, J-Mo.
Yeah. Another bad motherfucker.
That he is our West Montgomery / George Benson slash Eddie Hazel of our time. He's that guy. Marlon Williams is another one, and it's of course it's Charlie Burrell and whoever else you can think of. But the ones that we that brother right there is crazy.
Jubal.
I was just watching Jubal post earlier today playing with Maze. That's so stupid. That's so silly.
Jubal and Eric Wallace. Another one.
Man, we can go down the line with
Andre Bowman, bass player.
Andre. Yeah, Andre's stupid.
Yeah, Andre's stupid too.
Brody stupid. Bubby.
Oh man. Chucky.
Oh.
Chucky on Strat.
Come on, Chuck. Uncle Chuck. Jesus.
And Uncle Dave. Don't leave Uncle Dave out.
Yeah, man, I would never do that. It's so mean in the name. And we on this interview, we might get cursed out for not mentioning them Negroes.
Yeah, that's a fact.
Yeah,
well, shit, man, I ain't going to hold you, bro. Like, this is long overdue. We definitely had to chop it up, but, you know, we're putting this out mañana.
Man, I appreciate this because, man, this is gasoline for me to have a reason to turn my equipment on. Instead of just because you have it, and you know, don't mean you can. You need to be inspired.
Right.
And I'm inspired in this conversation right now. I got an opportunity. I'm doing something with Shaka Khan. I don't want to do it without you. I had a nice conversation with her yesterday.
Oh man, well shit, that's done.
Let's get it in.
My sister's a huge Shaka Khan. She turned me on to Shaka Khan. And one of the first records I sampled was a Shaka Khan record.
Now it's time to share with her and give her appreciation and her flowers and why we did what we did. Or why we do what we do.
And tell her I said she looked like an older Nicki Minaj. My bad.
If you ain't married now, nigga, you might end up, she might kidnap your ass selling her dad. And you said, Nutcake, that's my dude. Hey, I love you, brother. Thank you for the opportunity. Man, Bink About It podcast, one of my favorite, my favorite right now. The next one would be mine because I'm coming right behind you. Thank you, brother. I salute.
Coming up here, brother. Love you, brother. Love.